Hi, my name's Nikki Anderson, and I'm director of the Feminist Writers Festival. Welcome to this podcast of our FWF 2020 session, Craftivism, made possible by Queen Victoria Women's Centre. Here, artist Casey Jenkins, Queen Vic Women's Centre feminist in residence Kate Robinson, creative designer Tanisha Atkinson, novelist Enza Gandolfino, and writer-activist Van Badham talk craft and feminist resistance and creating change one stitch at a time. We acknowledge that this recording took place across Australia on First Nations lands, lands whose sovereignty has never been ceded.
Good evening, and welcome to Craftivism at the Feminist Writers Festival 2020. Now, let's welcome our craftivists. Tanisha Atkinson is a Yorta Yorta woman living in Bundjalung country and is a freelance writer, creative director, and intersectional feminist. Van Badham is a regular columnist for The Guardian, an irregular commentator on TV, a screenwriter and playwright whose work has been performed around the world, a sometime writer of fiction, memoir and poetry, and chair of the Queen Victoria Women's Centre Trust. She co-hosts a weekly news podcast called The Week on Wednesday. Enza Gandolfo is a Melbourne writer and author of two novels, Swimming and The Bridge. She is also co-author of several non-fiction books, including Inventory on Op Shops and It Keeps Me Sane, Women Craft Wellbeing. She comes from a long line of women craft makers and has inherited their love of textiles, especially knitting and embroidery. Casey Jenkins is a live art installation and community artist using performance, textiles, and intervention to explore intimacy, identity, and the interplay between modes of power. And your chair this evening is Kate Robinson, a biracial family violence lawyer based in Melbourne and the inaugural feminist in residence at the Queen Victoria Women's Centre. Kate's craftivism project, Make a Fuss, is a collection of over 150 crowdsourced works that answer the question, what do you no longer want to be silent about? Let me now hand over to Kate and the panelists. Welcome all to Craftivism.
Hello, everyone. Last session of the Feminist Writers Festival. I'm so excited to be here with you all. And just a warm welcome from me to our blind and visually impaired friends. So a short description of what I look like. I am a 30-year-old woman. I am wearing a very colourful dress. I have long, dark, curly brown hair, and I'm Iranian Australian, so I'm vaguely ethnic looking. I also really want to acknowledge that today I'm on the traditional lands of the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung people and Wurrung people, and just pay my respects to their elders, past, present, and emerging. And I guess for me, something that's really important in that acknowledgement is, you know, the work starts with the acknowledgement, it doesn't end there. And so for me, being on these stolen lands, that means respecting the land. And, you know, that doesn't include things like destroying culturally significant birthing trees. And I think for me, it's NAIDOC Week. And NAIDOC Week has a really incredible history and origin story and roots in activism and protest. And today we're here talking about craft and activism. And I just wanted to start with you, Casey. And just ask, which came first for you? Was it the craft, or was it the activism, or a combination?
I'm beaming in from Wurundjeri country as well. Thanks for the intro. Which came first for me? It was activism. So I started making protest, I suppose, a bit over a decade ago, really sort of trying to get engaged in political processes, and then found craftivism a great sort of avenue to do that, and then that sort of led to discovering sort of more in-depth sort of love of crafting itself, rather as just sort of a pragmatic vehicle to get a message across.
I guess for me, the really beautiful thing about craft and creating is, you know, the fact that it doesn't feel like real high-end art, like, kind of makes it more accessible. But I think craft sometimes gets a bad rap, and it's sometimes like seen to be women's work, or, you know, that it's places in the household. And I'm interested, Enza, what your thoughts are around that. And I know, you know, you are an incredible crafter, and your mother was an incredible crafter as well. And so how your ideas about it being women's work have shifted over your lifetime.
Thanks, Kate. Look, I also want to start by acknowledging that I'm speaking from the lands of the Wurundjeri people and the Kulin Nation, and I want to acknowledge them as the traditional owners and custodians of this land. I also want to acknowledge them as the first storytellers on this land and also the first makers on this land, and what a wonderful tradition they have in both stories and in the art. I guess for me, craft has had a very complicated kind of blurry history. You know, as a young woman growing up in the 1960s, and my mother, you know, both made her living from craft, but also, you know, in that she worked in textile factories, but she also did it as something that she loved. But for me, I saw it as representing a sort of certain kind of womanhood. You know, my father was very domineering. We lived in a very strict migrant Sicilian family. And craft represented everything I didn't want for my life. I wanted another sort of life, a life that was different to my mother's. So I spent most of my childhood rejecting craft, so much so that the only subject I failed at school was needlework. I didn't do very good at cooking either, but needlework was my worst subject. I failed it. And I think that was just, I just didn't want to have anything at all to do with that world. I wanted a career and I wanted to go to university. And even though I was a working class migrant kid, I had those ambitions. But once I sort of left home and started to think more about feminism, and I started to see that the whole diminishing of craft was a way that the patriarchal society really diminishing women's work. And I realized and I started to see that my mother had used her craft as a form of resistance. It's how she made space away from my father, how she carved an identity for herself that was not wife or mother. You know, she was known in the community for someone who could make things for other people. She was known as someone who had a skill in that. So I started to see that that's how she told her story about her life and about her history and about what it meant to be a migrant woman. So it was a long journey, and it took a long time for me to come round to it. And I find, you know, that I think craft was always in my DNA, and once I finally sort of came to terms with that, it's, you know, part of my life, and I can't imagine not making.
Tanisha, I'm wondering, like, well, I love this idea of craft as a form of resistance, and I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about, you know, craft and its ability to decenter privilege.
Sure. I firstly just wanted to as well acknowledge the traditional owners. So I'm on Bundjalung country, and I just wanted to acknowledge and pay my respects to the Bundjalung people, their elders past and present. And I also wanted to extend that respect to any Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander people that are watching or listening in today. I just wanted to talk a little bit about where I'm from as well. So as was mentioned, I'm a very proud Yorta Yorta woman. So the Yorta Yorta people are in northern Victoria, and my family form a part of the Atkinson clans around Maroopna and Shepparton, with ties to the Maloga and the Kamaragunja missions. But I guess when I think about craftivism and I guess thinking about activism, as Aboriginal people, our existence is resistance. I guess by us being born, that's a form of protest in itself, because there's been so much over time and so much that's continuing to be perpetuated that sort of suggests that we weren't meant to be here. But here we are thriving and continuing to succeed and continuing to share. And I just wanted to acknowledge as well that ancestral memory is more than a concept. So when it comes to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, our protest and our anger but also our storytelling is decades old. So I guess in itself, everything that we're doing today is a form of resistance. So I believe that craft and art and storytelling, that has the ability to decenter privilege. So much of privilege is centered in so-called Australia. And if you are outside of that, you are just considered an other in every single thing that you do. But what craft and art allows us to do is it stops centering privilege and it gives us the agency. So instead of being the talked about all the time, we become the people that are talking, people that are storytelling. And what that allows is it allows space for other voices that have been shouting and that have been talking for so long. So I guess just in everything that we're doing, it is a sign of resistance. And a little bit about, I guess, my own personal experience over the last few months. I've never considered myself an activist. That certainly isn't a title that I hold. I've never considered myself to really be someone that participates a lot in craft. But it was during the intersection of lockdown and when the world was really watching the Black Lives Matter movement and a lot of injustices that were happening across the world, I was at home, working from home like many people fortunate enough to still do so, and I was just getting really, really angry. And like I said, the anger that I hold is just decades old. So that anger was already there. It's really coming on top. So I needed to do something. I needed to speak out. I'm a big believer that neutrality, it's just complacency and that is difference. That's an action in my opinion. So I started creating some resources just to share a little bit of, education, I guess, and just to make sure that I wasn't staying neutral. And through those sort of resources and sharing some content online, I guess that was considered craft, and a lot of people were responding really, really well to that. And there were so many other people that did it. And what that did was, like I said at the start, it was just decentering privilege.
The resources are incredible. People should go to your Instagram and check them out for sure. There's this like one line I'm going to quote because it gave me all the feelings. And it's the introduction of color to determine someone's Aboriginality is a colonial tool introduced as an act of genocide. Mm-hmm. Sorry, shouldn't swear. then you, like many creatives, wear a lot of different hats. We've talked a lot about that already with the panelists, I guess, in terms of all the different things you're doing. You are obviously a very well-known journalist for The Guardian, but also a playwright. And I'm wondering about if you could just talk to us about the interplay between your journalism and your playwriting, and I guess whether journalism has freed up some space, I guess, in terms of the themes and the things that you then explore through theatre.
I speak to you from Wathaurong country today, and I pay my respects to elders past, present and emerging. It's obviously it's humbling to be on Wathaurong land because it is so beautiful. I also want to provide a description of myself. I look like a state school art teacher who was too drunk to remember to get her roots done, and that is a fairly accurate visual description of me right now. I don't identify as a craftivist. I practice craft. I do some lovely lino cuts. I'm always up for making a costume, and I did some really great work with my bathroom tiles. But I'm a writer, and my engagement politically and with activism is through the act of writing. And I didn't train as a journalist. I trained as a playwright and dramaturg and had a very long apprenticeship in the theatre. I studied poetry at university, and really the experience of my education was for me to understand that a mastery of words and rhetoric and the literary practice of writing was my means of pursuing my mission as a Gramscian Marxist, which is to make a long march through the institutions. So as a feminist and as a Marxist feminist, my interest is in invading the institutions of oppression and claiming them for the oppressed. So I have a very codified way of engaging around my writing practice. I have come to separate what is artistic practice from activist practice. I don't see particularly the theatre or screen or television or novels or poetry as a means of a direct political engagement. I see it as enhancing a cultural conversation and using the mastery of craft in order to do that. In terms of looking at what I do politically, it's very focused on creating, like working with institutional power and gaining structural and cultural power in order to influence decision making around legislation and resources through the prism of Marxist feminist activism. And I'm really specific about that because I do really enjoy the indulgence that comes with artistic practice. Like I love, you know, dressing up as the queen and running around a stage and inventing kingdoms that I live in. And my work as an artist is very much about looking at genre and looking at the way that genre has implicit assumptions about gender and tearing those apart and removing the assumptions of gender from popular genres. Like I write a lot of sci-fi, I dabble in film noir. I'm doing a big project at the moment which is taking apart the genre of beach party movies, and looking at the gender dynamics in that. But I separate my artistic practice as a place to speculate and engage with a cultural conversation as opposed to journalistic practice, which is very much, from my perspective, an assault on power. As an activist, as a feminist, I'm interested in going where patriarchy is, and I'm interested in prying their hands off the machines of oppression and destroying their capacity to dominate those machines.
Casey, I'm wondering what, I guess, if you could just reflect a bit on what Van has just talked about, because you very much describe yourself as a craftivist, but you also use your body very specifically as, you know, kind of a canvas in a way for your artistic practice. And I'm wondering if you could talk to us a bit about that and, I guess, yeah, you know, how you came to using your body itself.
Sure. Yeah, I do like describing myself as a craftivist, mainly because people have told me not to, because they say, oh, it's a demotion. People won't take you seriously. You have to present yourself as a great artiste. But, and so I love that. I find that so interesting that, because it's associated with women, it's considered lesser. It's, and so I, for that reason, often do go, nah, I'm a craftivist. I'm not an artist. I'm a craftivist. But, you know, like it depends what context it's in, you know, you use what fits, which hat fits best for, you know, which purpose. I have gone from over maybe the past 7 years creating works that center my body, as you say, and that I still do sort of collective or try and sort of organize collective actions, but the reason that I wanted to make works that center my own body was from a desire to not override anyone else's autonomy. So I had been making works that tried to speak to issues of gender and feminism sort of en masse, and it has, and that has its merits, but it also is very problematic. So because you can't in feminism, you can't speak for everyone. You can't, there's no sort of overriding, unifying action, unfortunately. That doesn't mean they're not without merit. Some things have had that have tried to unify have been, I think, both sort of wonderful and problematic, like that sort of pussy hat kind of things that sort of they've been at, you know, at once sort of galvanizing and then highlighting of fracture within within political movements. And so I started making works that where sort of gallery based durational works, sometimes incorporating craft, sometimes not, for the specific purpose of just speaking from my perspective and no one else's.
Enza, I know, so Enza is an incredible embroidery, so that for everyone playing along at home, in the background of her image you might be able to see a woman's face, and that's actually a self-portrait that she did. Enza, I know that you've been looking at and thinking about your body more recently in your embroidery work, and I was wondering if you could talk a bit about that. But I'm also curious, because obviously you're a writer, whether your approach to writing and embroidery is different or similar, or it was similar in some way.
I think it is similar in some ways. Like, I started lockdown. I mean, the reason I got into embroidery this year was because I, at the beginning of lockdown, I thought I need to learn a new skill. And so I decided, I'd been to Japan recently, and I thought I'll learn shishiko, which is a very Japanese form of embroidery. But I didn't stick to it because it was a bit too structured. And I ended up just wanting to sort of do my own thing rather than that structure. And I realized that what I'm interested in embroidery, same thing that I'm interested in with writing, which is what stories are not being told, what stories are invisible culture, so, and how can we tell those stories? How can I tell those stories? So, you know, I'm very interested in class. Like, my last novel, The Bridge, is very much about working class people. It's about the collapse of the Westgate Bridge, about the men who worked on the bridge. It's about the way the West of Melbourne changed and what impact that's had on working class young women, like the young woman in the media now versus how it was when all of us were working class in the West. So I'm interested in telling stories about women and about the working class and about my. And so when I started to do the embroidery, I realized that I started to go towards narrative and that kind of exploration. And when I saw the fuss call, I thought, well, okay, so what are some of the things that I'm silent about in my life that I want people to look at differently? And, you know, for all of my life, I've been a big woman, and for all of my life, I've been bigger than the accepted norm. And I weighed myself every day for many, many years, and my whole mood was, you know, ruled by what was said on that particular morning. And really, it wasn't until my 50s where I went, I was going to swear as well then. What a waste of time, you know. And once I stopped doing that, I sort of freed myself up, right? And it wasn't that I had done things, you know, it wasn't like I focused on my weight, but that's how it felt. And to say to young women, and, you know, young women especially, you know, just accept your body and not worry. It takes so much time and energy and stops you doing all the wonderful things that you have the potential to do. But I thought where to start is to kind of accept your own body. And for me, the piece was about doing something never done before. So I got my husband to take photos of me. I had never had a photo taken of me nude, and then I embroidered. So I had to kind of confront looking at my own body and going, you know, this is what my body is, and it's got me here, and, you know, it's a body and it functions and it shouldn't be looked down upon and hidden because it doesn't fit the sort of societal norm.
Mm.
I'm not sure I answered your question, but that's
no, you definitely did. And I think while you were talking, Tanisha was giving you a lot of nods. So I'm wondering if it sparked something for you, Tanisha.
Yeah, definitely. So I shaved my head a few weeks ago, and you know, I was lucky enough to not have the need to shave my head. It was a choice, and I guess it was one of those things where I wanted to challenge the social norms and this beauty as a social construct, and the pressure that we put on ourselves to have to conform whilst in the meantime people are profiting off our insecurities, the insecurities that people invent and, you know, attach to us. And then what happens is we not only uphold them within ourselves, but we project those insecurities onto everyone else around us and think that they're not enough or they're not good enough as they are. So something that I've done a little bit in my career, I've spent a lot of time talking with young people and facilitating workshops. And something I always wanted to say and leave our young people with is that you are enough as you are. People are profiting off your own self-doubt. You're amazing. You're wonderful as you are. And I guess it's so important that we're practicing what we preach. So I just decided to shave my hair off and get rid of a bit of extra baggage and just love myself in my rawness as I am. Mm. You know, as I was
and born. Through some of your work with Clothing the Gap, like in your creative directing, like I know that you really try to subvert stereotypes. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
So I was very lucky to have the opportunity to work with Clothing the Gap. The head of brand and marketing, Sienna Cotullo, is a very, very good friend of mine. We both did the Indigenous Marathon project last year where we had the opportunity to run the New York Marathon. You know, that's another yarn for another day. but their work has really been so phenomenal over the last few months. And given the restrictions that were happening in Melbourne, like all of the panelists would have experienced, I was lucky enough to, you know, have the autonomy to sort of go anywhere in Queensland and Northern New South Wales. So Clothing the Gap reached out to me and sort of said, can you help direct a shoot? What do we want to look like? These are some of the themes that we want to explore. So something that I guess was passionate about is we don't need people to look like stereotypical models. And nothing against stereotypical models. Everybody's beautiful, but you don't have to look a certain way to be the face of a brand. You don't have to look a certain way or do something to be, you know, representative of everyone. So in the most recent shoot we did, Clothing the Gap reached out and said, we don't just want models. We want people who are putting in work in their communities and that are bringing their community up with them and that are talking about these really challenging issues that a lot of, the mainstream white media choose to not listen to and choose to not elevate. So instead of looking for very, very, attractive and the, you know, accepted standards of people, but I must say they're all so beautiful, we got people who were, as I said, putting in the work and that were, you know, very well connected in their communities. So something as well that we were looking at, I made sure to get some beautiful native, you know, I'm obsessed with native flowers, and I asked one of the followers to get a photo with these flowers to sort of there's a lot of a lot of connotations around black men, needing to be very, very masculine. But, you know, we got these flowers to sort of dismantle that toxic masculinity a little bit and show the softness and show the gentleness so we don't all have to conform to this one standard.
Mm. And for people that don't know the work that Clothing the Gap do you want to just talk a little bit about the Free the Gap?
So Clothing the Gap, they are an Aboriginal fashion label. So this is actually one of their T-shirts. And for people who can't see this T-shirt, it is a black T-shirt with a white Aboriginal flag on it, which is called the Empty Flag Tee. So within the clothing that Clothing the Gap reproduces, there's also a lot of advocacy work involved in that as well. So they're really using their platform, as I said, to highlight, to elevate and to amplify these issues and these voices that aren't being elevated or spoken about. And at one point, Clothing the Gap were sent a cease and desist for their use of the Aboriginal flag on clothing. The Aboriginal flag is actually copyrighted, and a non-Indigenous organisation owns the copyrights to the flag. So essentially, any Indigenous organisation that wants to use the Aboriginal flag on their clothing to profit, they have to pay this non-Indigenous organisation. So Clothing the Gap have led the movement to free the flag and to see how we can remove this copyright so organisations can reproduce merchandise with the flag on it. I can't even explain the sense of pride that you feel when you see the flag. Like I said, our existence is resistance. So there's so much tied and so much connected to the flag. It's very important work.
I guess There's so much there. I'm curious about, this is the last question I'll ask you, then I'll move on to someone else, but I'm curious about, like when you talk about the resources that you created, dealing with some of the stereotypes and, you know, problematic questions that people might ask you, like, why did you choose Instagram in particular as the place to do that activism work?
So I, I think it leads into the fact that I've never considered myself to be an activist and to have very large audiences and you know, very strong platforms. But what I did know, you know, like many people of my generation, was very proficient in the use of social media. And I just, I guess the two resources in particular that I created, one was around appropriate terminology when referring to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. I remember in my former role, I was looking at the media clips for work and I just saw all these offensive and incorrect and inconsistent terminologies used. And it's something that is quite easy, you know, to be able to learn about. So I just said, you know what, people respond really well to Instagram and to Instagram tiles. So I taught myself how to use Photoshop like Enza. I said, what can I do that I haven't been doing? Taught myself how to use Photoshop, you know, did some writing and uploaded these tiles on Instagram just because I was tired of hearing and reading these offensive things. You know, it's 2020 now. I don't know why they're still happening.
Yeah. Van, I'm interested, you have also moved into a new space during lockdown and you are now podcasting. Do you want to talk to us a little bit about why you decided to go into that realm and I guess how you found it as a medium for doing your activism?
Well, I mean, it's just an extension of the work that I do. So I'm obviously very active on social media. I use social media to prolong the conversations that I broach in my columns and to speak back to power. And stuck at home, my partner and I are obviously comrades and are very much on the same page when it comes to the intervention that we want to make in terms of political discourse. And the podcast enables us to plug the hole that we see in mainstream media, which is to have an unashamedly left class-based analysis of the news. And so the podcast is just an extension of that. And, I mean, the thing that I've become very aware of since I started writing for The Guardian is that in terms of looking at the way that we talk about politics in this country, that there is a divide between people who have what I would consider to be just extraordinary left instincts without the layers of education around specifically things like economics. And in terms of looking at the way that women can, in particular, influence political conversation, remembering that women overwhelmingly dominate social media, the women, because of the way that women are socialised, I don't think there's any inherent biological quality to your ability to communicate, but because of the way that women are socialised and become these authoritative voices in conversations about family and about identity and about political community, that there's a real need for just explicit, respectful discussion of the way that things like macroeconomics and electoral systems and party machinery actually works. And there needs to be a place to have discussions around the actual machinations of power. And that is really, that's how I approach every single column I write, anytime that I do a television appearance, my podcast and all the other kind of media engagements I do is based around that idea that one of the smartest people I know is my mother, and yet my mother was educated at a time where she was essentially bullied to leave school because she was working class to get a job. She was discouraged from pursuing formal education. She was merely seen in terms of her productive capacity as a working class woman in an economy where she could be paid less on the basis of her gender. And she's one of the most powerful intellects I've ever encountered in my life. My mother deserves to have the confidence to participate in a political discussion and a discussion around economics and a discussion around the allocations of resources in an economy. And my role is to make sure that my mother has the confidence to have that conversation by the media products that I create. And I think that's incredibly important, because one of the things that I've realised, like, I'm from a working class family and I went to state school, and that means that I'm completely unrepresentative of the majority of media makers in this country and the majority of people in newsrooms. The idea that 65% of Australians who have a state education are underrepresented when it comes to the way that we speak to ourselves in the mass media is genuinely terrifying to me. And when we talk about representation, one of the great undiscussed issues of representation in this country is class. And yet there is a massive difference in coming from a working class family if you are a queer woman, if you are a woman with disabilities, if you are a Black woman, if you have the experience of being marginalised on the basis of your class, that compounds your marginalisation on the basis of your other identities as well. And yet, as a society, Australia is really uncomfortable with that discussion. And yet, if we have honest conversations about the way that the economy works and the way that it positions people and how the workplace is still overwhelmingly the overwhelming determinant of the opportunities you can and can't enjoy in your individual and community life, we need to open channels to have those discussions, because the way that we're disempowered is being marginalised from them. There's a really good book by Richard Dennis called Econobabble, which really sort of nails the point about the way that the ruling class use language to keep people out of the discussions that affect them. And when we use writing to articulate that these are not, you know, these are not secret religions, there is no like cabal meeting with precious knowledge of economists, you know, there is not some white male ownership of what electoralism looks like, that's when we actually become very dangerous, because we can take their tools and their weapons away from them and repurpose them to our own empowerment. And that's, you know, that's all of the work that I do. And obviously I'm part of a movement of people who are trying to do that and to, you know, force open the gates of that discussion, and using social media to do that in the way that we didn't used to be able to do that through mass media. And I think it is creating spaces for those kind of discussions to occur. I mean, it's still unbelievably hard, and it is genuinely terrifying for me to feel as if I've had like statistically a mainstream experience by going to state school, and yet not seeing that in the fora that I engage with as a writer is genuinely terrifying to me.
And so you also, I want to have the tough identity conversation, because I love talking about identity, because I'm biracial, so I guess I have spent my whole life, you know, feeling like I am too much of something or not enough of something else. And Enza, you grew up in the western suburbs in Melbourne. You're also from a working class family. You know, your parents were Sicilian migrants, and you know that obviously that has shifted over time. Now, you know, the western suburbs in Melbourne are very different. And I'm just curious, like, to hear some of your reflections on, like, your sense of belonging and like intergenerational connection to place and some of those big ideas.
Yeah, I think they are, you know, I mean, I thought a lot about class, obviously, because I've written a lot about class in my fiction, you know, and the West has changed a lot. So the West has a lot of middle class people now, as well as a lot of working class people, and that has an impact on the working class people that are still living here. And often a very a negative impact, because, you know, those differences. I mean, I think what Van said is so true. You know, in Australia, we just want to deny class. It's like we're all equal, and if you work hard enough, you can get there too. And it's not true. You know, it's not true. And we've seen that in COVID so well. You know, like, who has suffered most in COVID have been the frontline workers, which in the main part are working class people in casualised jobs, in retail, in aged care, you know, people who are driving the trucks and doing the deliveries. And they're the people who've been most hit by what's happened. The rest of us have been able to work from home because we've got middle class jobs that allow for that. Identity for me, I mean, look, I'm, I, will always identify as working class, even though, you know, I'm clearly now a middle class woman. I growing up in the 50s and 60s, I was the WOG kid. And, you know, Dagos, the Italians were dirty and, you know, had to keep away from them. So there was a lot of that sort of prejudice. But I do consider myself, you know, I'm a white woman who's has, you know, benefits from the privilege of living in a society that unfortunately still discriminates on the basis of race. And so, you know, like all white women, I think, you know, and as a feminist white woman, I'm culpable in that and I need to be aware of that. And we need to make room for more diversity. You know, we need to not just talk about having more women in power. We need to talk about having women from diverse backgrounds in power, you know, women, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander women and black women from different migrant backgrounds and working class women. And I think that those are the sorts of conversations that I'm interested in having. And I think it can be hard sometimes. I know in my own group of women, you know, women who come from migrant working class backgrounds often feel like they've really struggled hard and they've had the, you know, there's been discrimination. But I think we do have to look at the privileges that we're getting from living in the society that we live in and how, you know, for me, feminism has always been a collective. You know, I don't prescribe to a kind of individualist idea of feminism where I've made it, you know, I've got to the top of my career and isn't that great? For me, I came to feminism as a teenage girl in a patriarchal family, and those voices that I could hear were the sort of light at the end of a dark tunnel for me. And I think that it's now, you know, my place as an older feminist to create that light for younger feminists that come from all from very diverse backgrounds. But I think we need to create space for those conversations. Like, people are really scared to have those conversations. And I think, I don't know how we do that, but I think we need to have more of those conversations within feminism.
Mm. Tanisha, how did you feel, I guess, putting yourself out there when you created those resources? Like, I find it really scary to be like, I'm putting my name to this and I'm saying this and I'm talking about these tough things. How was that for you, I guess, or did that figure in your creative process, I guess, as well?
I guess in the moment, I was just doing anything I could to redirect my energy. But I also do want to acknowledge that I am a white passing person, and like Enza was saying, I have a different set of privileges than a lot of other Aboriginal people and other Aboriginal women have. So it's really important that when I'm speaking out, I'm not speaking on behalf of everybody, and it's important that I do acknowledge my privileges as well. You know, the resources that I did make, I was getting messages saying that some universities were using those resources as an introduction to Indigenous studies for some of their class, for some of their classes. I didn't expect that to happen at all. So I was, in that sense, positioned as the person, you know, being able to provide that advice. But like I said, I'm definitely not an activist, in that sense. But something that I did as well want to touch on, that I wish I had touched on earlier, was something that came out very strongly for me, when I did create those resources and they did have such an overwhelming impact. I realized that the revolution starts at home, and I've thought a lot about this, and I've been thinking a lot about systems and institutions that, you know, they're only centered in privilege. And I was thinking a lot about how people were looking to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people during the Black Lives Matter movement to say, educate me, help me learn, help me understand. And it wasn't the government they were looking towards. It wasn't big education institutions that they were looking towards. It was, you know, having one-on-one conversations, phone calls, just everyday yarns. And that led me to believe that the revolution really starts at home, you know, dismantling, you know, the patriarchy and all these institutions that continue to oppress people who are not privileged. That starts at home. It starts in where we buy our clothing. It starts in, you know, having proper access at schools. It starts in the conversations that we're having at the dinner table, the conversations that we allow to slide, the jokes that we, you know, sort of laugh off and don't want to disrupt. So that's just something I really wanted to say. The revolution, it starts at home.
Casey, what do you think about that idea of the revolution starting at home?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that it's, I think that there's a lot of power held by people who don't realize that they hold it. And I think that it's, that craftivism is a form of activism that is really accessible by, a lot of people from different classes. It's a very sort of entry level because it doesn't have that sort of reputation of being a, hoity-toity, you know, this really complex thing. And so in that way it engages a lot of people who wouldn't originally consider themselves activists. It kind of eases them into the process. There are some who are still left out in the dark, like in some projects. So it's sort of because in any sort of the ability to protest is a privilege. You're sort of being able to put yourself on the line. I know I've done sort of a lot of, or tried to coordinate like street art things over the years of trying to get people who are not represented in street art out there. And I know I had an experience, some years ago trying to, do workshops for new migrants and refugees, but it came to like, well, I can go onto the street and do a craft action and being not afraid of, you know, having my knuckles wrapped. But there are people who are going like, I could get deported. Like, I'm not going to risk doing this, you know, action. I can't put my life on the line like that. So there are sort of being able to go out in public is a privilege, and that's something I think, like I mentioned the pussy hats before, that was sort of highlighted, I think, that in you sort of see, well, it's like a sea of white faces in the, like the protest itself, I don't think, like pussy hats, there were lots of different conversations around that, but just by creating this visual representation of a movement, the craft action kind of highlighted problems within that movement. There are other examples of that where where something that is accessible, and so you'd think that it's going to be accessed in an even, equitable way, and then when you sit back and go, who actually participated? You realise, there are problems with this whole movement, you know? The AIDS quilt, you know, like the biggest craftivist action in history, to my knowledge, where I don't know what the most recent stats are, but, like, there were some not so long ago, a few years ago, the, like, out of about 50,000 quilts that were made, there were only a few hundred representing African American. So it's like mainly US based and African American people who had died of AIDS. So it's a massive quilt project to honor and name people who've died from AIDS. And but then so once that was understood, that craft action sort of in itself highlighted what needs to be done in queer movements, you know, in AIDS support that wasn't being done. So there are, yeah, I feel like craftivism is accessible, and it's also interesting when it's not accessed.
And could you just tell, I feel like people might not know this, but you did this incredible piece called Body of Work that I feel like talks about or brings up some of these things for me. Could you just tell people that are listening a little bit about that project and what you were trying to explore in that?
Yeah, sure. I don't get asked about that one so much. Body of Work, I was hired out myself by the hour at different rates over a 3-week period from 9 to 5 at different rates that were commensurate with other entry-level workers from various backgrounds to sort of address sort of inequity in wage, like the what is our time worth. So people could hire me for example the price that a parent is, the wage a parent is given for raising a child, so $0 an hour, to and they could instruct me to do anything they wanted within the workspace that I'd set up. So they had me doing tasks like cutting hair, someone had me minding their kid, someone had me doing their tax returns, someone had me doing filing. So I was sort of interested in how, yeah, bodies and lives are valued in it seems to me quite an inane and arbitrary way.
Van, you have your roots in student activism, and I read somewhere that you cut up an effigy of Amanda Vanstone with a chainsaw. I would love to hear about some of your student activist practice, and I guess how it's changed now. In the campaign strategies that you use.
Yeah, so when I was a student activist, I obviously had no labour power and I had to work in the medium of disruption. I disagree that the revolution begins at home. I am a 1,000-year-old crusty Marxist and I genuinely believe the revolution starts at work, because if the system of hegemony is capitalistic and built into that, all of its assumptions that the oppressions that capitalism relies upon in order to perpetuate its profit machine, you have to fight capitalism with what it understands, which is money and resources. And, you know, as I've been a political activist for a very, very, very long time, and one of the hardest lessons to appreciate is that the enemy doesn't actually have a moral conscience. And I find this particularly around when I watch various movements for moral standards, get genuinely shocked that politicians aren't listening to them and are convinced that politicians just don't understand or haven't had a human connection. Otherwise, there's no way they would do these terrible things, like that Sri Lankan family who are currently in an island prison for no particular reason. Like, all we need to do is communicate their humanity and the people who put them there are suddenly going to change their minds. Like, that's just not true. Like, those who prop up the capitalist system, those who act on behalf of the property-owning ruling class, only understand one thing, and that is property. And when I was a student activist, I became very aware of the fact that I couldn't strike, I couldn't withdraw my labour, I couldn't interrupt the means of production by withdrawal of labour power. So I just had to cause as much trouble as possible and to try and mobilise institutional support from other communities in support of what we were arguing as students. That is, that education is a right, not a privilege, and there should be universal access to vocational training in any form. That's just basic standard. And, of course, we had a conservative Liberal government that was the only country in the OECD that was actually trying to restrict education access, that closed two entire university campuses, that was trying to mobilise the full commodification of education, and we had to do as much as we possibly could to stop it. And one of those things was to support academics taking strike action and thicken their numbers on picket lines and to interrupt that particular form of that particular means of production. And so my friend Mark and I spent $64.99 building a massive effigy of Amanda Vanstone, and we built an arterial system that was full of blood made out of black paint and cochineal. And we tested it we wore white suits and we carved her open with a chainsaw. And it was quite spectacular. And really looking at the strategy of that action was in the context of we had a lot of very nervous academics on picket lines who were literally risking their jobs in order to stand up for the principle of accessible education. And we were there to boost their morale. Like, and for them to feel less alone and for them to experience a visual act of solidarity, knowing that, you know, their sacrifices were not being made in vain. And like, I do a lot of that. I still do a lot of stuff like that. Like I organize visual protests and spectacles and disruptions and that. I do a lot of work in the trade union movement. I'm making all these short films explaining basic principles of left-wing laborist economics to people for the ACTU at the moment. And that's the kind of stuff that I do. But it's done within a very specifically calibrated strategy. What is the goal? What do we need to achieve in order for the goal to be realized? Who do we target? Who is this message for? What is the appropriate forum? Like, are we recruiting participants? Are we boosting morale? Are we targeting individuals? Are we disrupting the means of production? Are we creating a new media narrative so we can mobilize institutions that do have the power to interrupt what's being done? And it's a lifetime of experiences that goes into informing that as a successful strategy and learning where you can have a victory and what you need to do in order for that victory to come to pass. And it's a brutal lesson because, like, activism is like, especially when you're like young and hot, activism is fantastic. I remember bursting into a university staging an occupation with my hot left-wing boyfriend at the University of Western Sydney and us having a big pash up in this like room full of broken glass when cops came in to thump the shit out of us. It was fantastic. But, you know, and those experiences are life-changing and empowering and exciting, and you know, you become the star of your own movie. And I understand the impulse towards the theater and circus of activism because I've been there. I'm into it. Like, I totally get off on it. It's fantastic. But if you are actually trying to change society and do the brutally difficult work in a democracy, because social change is actually unbelievably hard in democracies because you have to persuade a majority of people to support what you are doing, the strategy and tactics and a sophistication around the way that you engage has got to come into play. Nothing breaks my heart more than bad activism or activism without strategy, activism without a goal, because I think the oppressed are relying on you for this to mean more than a performance. Like, the oppressed do not have the privilege of, you know, just sitting there and witnessing a bit of political theatre. If you get this wrong, people die or suffer or are imprisoned or exploited or hurt at work or experience no freedom or are left in an island prison with small children. Like, that is the cost of making a tactical error and not considering what strategy means and what we're trying to service. And it's really hard. Like, I cop a lot of shit on the internet, like every day ending in Y, about the way that I engage politically. But at the end of the day, like, if you are in service to progressive social change, that is a lifelong commitment, and you have to bear on your conscience the consequences on the oppressed for you getting anything wrong.
I'm so amazed by this entire panel discussion. I think something I'm going to walk away with is that line of causing as much trouble as possible, for sure. but I just want to thank all of you for, I guess, the generosity of spirit and honesty that you came to this discussion today, Enza, Tanisha, Casey, and also Van. And I also want to thank the Feminist Writers Festival for putting on this awesome event.
We hope you enjoyed the conversation. Our thanks to the speakers and chair, our podcast partner Listen Up Podcasting, Creative Victoria, the Beeson Family Foundation and Queen Vic Women's Centre for vital funding support. For more FWF goodness, visit our website, feministwritersfestival.com, and find us on socials.